Welcome to the Bible Girl Podcast. I'm Jessica Robinson, and I have a great love for God's Word, journal writing, and gel pens in every color. I combine these loves into one great passion, studying God's Word. Welcome to today's podcast. I'll be talking about suffering and a little bit about how God works in the midst of our suffering. Seems to be a topic that's been on my mind a lot lately. Earlier this year, I taught a little bit about suffering and really went through some things personally and watched some other people suffer. And I've been really wrestling with suffering and the idea of suffering, what it means to us as believers to be able to suffer well. I'll be speaking this weekend after a couple of days here. It'll be Saturday, the 24th of October. I'll be speaking at a ladies' retreat, and these are some of the things I'll be talking about. I'm unable to record that day, so I'm going to record my thoughts right now and post this as a podcast in a few weeks. I have been wrestling the past few weeks with what to share about suffering. I feel like my theology of suffering is still being molded. God is still teaching me new things. And so I want to say that this is where I'm at now, and God will continue, I think, to help me wrestle through these ideas and see Him more clearly in the midst of our suffering. So I say this is not a complete theology of suffering. This is my current theology of suffering. When we talk about a theology of suffering, theology is the study of God and understanding how He works in the world. I think it's important to realize that we need to understand where God is in suffering. When we experience suffering, oftentimes in many cultures, the first thing that we blame is God. In fact, all over the world, whether they trust in God the Father in heaven, or whether they have a lot of false gods or statues or idols, they think that the gods are angry when something bad happens. And we see this throughout history as well. People that, you know, in the Egyptians throwing their firstborn children and sacrifices in the Nile and things like that, so that the gods would be appeased and would give them good health and take away their pain. We see it all over the world and all over history. So people automatically assume that, you know, if there is a God, He has something to do with suffering. So it will be important for us to have a good theology of suffering, understanding how we believe that God works in the midst of pain. This is important for a couple of reasons. Number one, because we are going to suffer. If you're not suffering now, you will be at some point. And it would be helpful to have wrestled with these thoughts ahead of time and have a framework to view what you're going through in the correct way, so that God can work and so that you are not feeling adrift or abandoned by God. But it's also important because the more we know about God, the easier it is to love Him and to serve Him. It's difficult to follow a leader or follow someone who is giving you instructions or who has a plan laid out for you if you don't know who they are and you don't trust them. And so having a theology of suffering helps us when the path that God has laid out for us is difficult to continue on that path, because we have wrestled and we know who He is and we know Him better than we knew Him before and we trust Him more. To kind of tell you where my thoughts have been going lately, I want to share two stories from the Bible, and I'm just going to, instead of reading them for time's sake, I'm going to tell you their story very briefly. And I would like to just draw your attention then to the blog where I'll be posting the scriptures and you can read them in greater detail for yourself. Both of these stories are incredibly interesting. They read like novels and are very fascinating. So I think you would benefit from taking a few moments out of your day and reading one of them. In these two stories, I'm going to contrast how God is working in them, because He works very differently in them. There are some similarities, but God's actual, the way He is moving and the way He is working out the events in these stories are are unique to them. They're very different to each other. And so I'm going to start with the first one, and this is the Esther story. The Esther story God is a God who works ahead of the events. If you know anything about the story of Esther, I'm just going to very briefly summarize. Hopefully, if you don't know it, you'll read it yourself and get a good understanding of this. But Esther is a young woman who has been taken into captivity. Most likely, she was born into captivity. The Jewish people, the Israelite nation there in Jerusalem, and Israel had been taken captive by the Babylonians. And eventually the Persians overtook the Babylonians. And there is a large number of Jewish people who are living in Persia. And a lot of these old Babylonian cities that are now under Persian control. And they have assimilated into that culture and they're living there. And this is a young woman named Esther. She has been raised by her cousin Mordecai, and the king is in need of a new queen and has what's basically a beauty pageant, kind of pulls the most beautiful women in the land in and begins to try them out to see who was going to be his queen. And eventually he chooses Esther, and she is the queen who ends up saving her people. There is a man who works at the palace in a position of honor. His name is Haman. He hates the Jewish people, and he cooks up a plan to have them eradicated. And Esther is able, because of her position, to step in and save the day. And we see in this story several things that God does ahead of time, or things that God is actually working very visibly before they're needed. One of them is that her cousin Mordecai, who raised her, has a position of some influence in the palace. Now, he does not have the king's ear. Esther does when it comes time to plead for the Jews on in the story, Mordecai has to send Esther in to do it. He does not have a position in front of the king, but he does work in the palace, and it gives him access to Esther. It gives him the ability to have conversations with her, to get news to her, to let her know about what is happening and what is going on, things that she would most likely be unaware of. He was able to get to her because of his position. He had that position before Esther was ever taken, before Esther was ever brought into the king, before Esther became queen. He was positionally set up to be able to do this. Something else happens. Mordecai happens to be in the right place at the right time to hear about a plot to overthrow the king. He is able to get the message to the right people at the right time, and he saves the king's life. The king does not know about this until one night the king cannot sleep, and he says, "Send me for one of the scrolls." He's going to read the accounts, what's been going on in his kingdom. And the scroll they bring him is the scroll with the story of how Mordecai saved his life. That sets up a chain of events in this story that's quite interesting. And I'm not going to spoil it all for you. If you haven't read it, you need to read it. Mordecai is in a unique position here. And of all scrolls for the king to receive, he gets that scroll. This is God being proactive. He is positioning. I view the story of Esther as a giant chessboard, and God is positioning his pieces for checkmate. He is moving ahead of time. He is putting the right people in the right place at the right moment so that things will happen. We see this God, the story of Esther, Esther's God, is incredibly visible. He is working ahead of the events that will come. Now, let's contrast this with the story of Joseph. Joseph is the favorite son of Jacob. Jacob has 10 sons from other wives, but his favorite wife has only given him one son, Joseph. Joseph is not only favored by his father, but he is quite obviously favored by God. He has the ability to interpret dreams, and he, in his youthfulness and his lack of discretion, brags about this a bit to his brothers while he's wearing a special coat of many colors that his father has made for him to show that he is his father's favorite. And the animosity and jealousy stirring up in that family comes to a boil. And one day, Joseph's 10 brothers decide that they've had enough. They make a plan to kill him. They decide to sit down and have lunch first, so they throw him into a pit. And while they're enjoying their lunch, a caravan of slave traders comes by, and they decide to profit from him instead and let someone else take care of him, let Joseph be someone else's problem. So they sell him to the caravan, and Joseph heads off to a new land. He ends up in Egypt. He ends up as a slave in the household of one of the king's guards, Potiphar. While he's there, Potiphar's wife tries to seduce him, and when he refuses to go along with it, she has him falsely accused and thrown into prison. And then Joseph spends many years in prison. Until one day, he is able to correctly interpret the king's dream, the Pharaoh's dream, and he gets out of prison and he gets exalted to a very high position. For all of those years in slavery, Joseph toiled along doing what was right, and God was not seen. God worked after the events. In this case, after he was in slavery, God worked to give him favor with Potiphar, and when he was imprisoned, favor with the prison guards. God worked after he spent all that time in jail for one of the fellow prisoners who had been restored to his position with the Pharaoh to remember him and to tell Pharaoh, this young man, who's probably in his 40s at this point, can interpret your dream. This is God working after the suffering. This is God working in the midst of it. This is after the event has happened, God works. This is a different way of showing up. But in both of these stories, God is visible and present, whether he is working ahead of it or whether he's working after it. He may be visible in this moment, or he may be visible later, but in all cases, God is present. He may be operating fast or slow, but in all cases, he is moving. He shows up. He walks beside. He is active and present in your circumstances, regardless of if you see him moving before or redeeming afterwards. Several years ago now, my nephew and I were in the car. He was in the back seat eating some chicken nuggets. We were headed someplace, and I had gotten him something to eat. He was trying to figure out, he was about 4 years old, he was trying to figure out some complicated family dynamics. My parents are divorced. My father is remarried and has a son who is a year older than my nephew. So my nephew knows his son is just his friend, not quite really realizing that it's actually his uncle, and not quite understanding the family relationship of who grandpa actually is, and because it's just his friend's dad. And he was very confused by this, and he was trying to work it all out in his head, and he was kind of verbally talking it out loud with me. And finally, he just stopped, and he says, well, maybe I'll understand it one day. And then he went back to eating his chicken nuggets and moved on to a completely different topic. I got a little chuckle out of that. My first thought was, well, maybe you won't. It is a little bit confusing. But I think about that sometimes because I think that's the attitude that God wants us to have. Compared to God, we are just children. We do not have the reasoning capabilities that we do, and we don't see what he sees. We don't know the future. We don't know the plan. We don't know what's coming next. We don't even know if we're getting our next breath. Suffering doesn't make sense. It will never make sense to us. So just like my nephew who gave it up and went back to his chicken nuggets, we need to stop trying to figure it all out. We need to acknowledge the fact that it does not make sense to us. But that doesn't mean that God is not there present, walking with us, active. We need to rest in the one who works both ahead of difficulties and after to fulfill all of his purposes for us. In closing, I want to share with you a couple lines of dialogue from a TV show that I love. I quote this dialogue a lot. I talk to people and I use it to encourage them. I'll be ending the retreat next this weekend with this quote and showing this clip. I feel like there's a little bit of theology tucked away in it that's so important to understanding what we're going through in our lives right now. It's from the TV show Doctor Who. I know Doctor Who has a lot of fans and also a lot of people who don't quite get it. So I'm going to set up the plot here for you. Doctor Who is a time traveler, a time lord who controls time and space and can travel back in time and forward in time and to other planets and other universes. In this particular account, Doctor Who has traveled back in time to the height of World War II. And he's currently in London with his companion Rose, and they're dashing around trying to save the city from not only the Germans, but an underlying alien problem that is going on in the city. And the doctor has come across this young girl named Nancy. Nancy's probably maybe 15 years old. She's got a whole group of young children who have been orphaned by the war, who are living with her in a little shed. She sneaks out at night during the raids when the Germans are dropping bombs on London and people are huddled down in their bomb shelters, and she sneaks into their homes and she gets food for the children that she's taking care of and sneaks back out. She has a rough life. They're suffering. Nancy's in an interesting place because she is a child doing the work of an adult. She is dealing with responsibilities beyond her understanding and her abilities. And I think we all can relate to that. Dealing with things we don't feel equipped to handle, things that come up out of nowhere, and we do the best we can. But we're struggling, and we're struggling to find hope. And in the midst of this situation, Nancy and the doctor's companion named Rose are hanging out by a chain link fence, cutting the barbed wire. They're trying to get into a hospital compound that's locked away. And Nancy has some questions. She kind of wants to know who this crazy doctor is who's talking about the future. And she says, Rose says that we're from the future. We're from your future. And Nancy says, okay, I believe you, whatever. I'll believe anything. You have a time travel machine, but what future? Nancy thinks the world's ended. She thinks the world is about to end. She doesn't believe there's a future. And Rose replies and she says, Nancy, this isn't the end. I know how it looks, but it's not the end of the world or anything. Listen to me. I was born in this city. I'm from here in like 50 years' time. Nancy replies incredulously. She can't understand this. From here? And Rose says, I'm a Londoner from your future. And Nancy just looks at her for a minute and she says, but you're not German. Nancy's already given in. In Nancy's mind, they're just holding out as long as they can, and the Germans are going to win. The darkness is going to take over. And I think Nancy, as much as she's trying to take care of the children under her command, for her, the future's bleak. And Rose says, Nancy, the Germans don't come here. They don't win. Don't tell anyone I told you so. But you know what? You win. And every time I watch that scene, I get teary-eyed because I see myself. I see myself struggling sometimes in situations that just seem like they never end. I see myself suffering in things that I think, I know that God could be the Esther God here. He could step in and I could have avoided this. And far too often, I get the Joseph story God, where God's redeeming the pain and the suffering and using it for his glory. But this isn't the end. It doesn't end like this. We have a glorious future. Evil doesn't win. God has already won, and we know this. And so, like the verse in 1 Peter chapter 4, verse 19, reminds us that those who are suffering according to God's will should continue what is doing what is good and trust themselves to a faithful Creator. Because as 2 Corinthians 4:17 says, "For our light momentary affliction is preparing for us an eternal weight of glory beyond all comparison." My theology of suffering is that sometimes the Esther God shows up and sometimes the Joseph God shows up, but God always shows up. God is always present. God works ahead, or God redeems what has happened. But in either case, He is here with me. And ultimately, we win. Thanks for joining me today. If you have questions or comments, you can email me at BibleGirlPodcast@gmail.com. You can find me on Instagram, Twitter, Goodreads, and Pinterest under the username Jessie L. Robinson. And that's Jessie with an I, J-E-S-S-I-L Robinson. You can get articles, show notes, links to things referred to on the podcast, and more on my Tumblr blog, which is BibleGirlPodcast.tumblr.com. Links to all my social media and blog sites are on the podcast page at BibleGirl.podbean.com.